This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'm fascinated by John Muir and have gotten off the shelf a too long neglected copy of his The Story of My Boyhood and Youth. I'll share excerpts of his vivid recollections that he wrote only a year before his death in 1914. We start out in Dunbar, Scotland. He was born in 1838. He describes a severely disciplined childhood and travel with him and his family to settle in Wisconsin when he was 11. And now, parts of Chapter 1. When I was a boy in Scotland, I was fond of everything that was wild, and all my life I've been growing fonder and fonder of wild places and wild creatures. Fortunately, around my native town of Dunbar, by the stormy North Sea, there was no lack of wildness, though most of the land lay in smooth cultivation. With red-blooded playmates wild as myself, I loved to wander in the fields to hear the birds sing, and along the seashore to gaze and wonder at the shells and seaweeds, eels and crabs in the pools, among the rocks when the tide was low, and best of all to watch the waves in awful storms thundering on the black headlands and craggy ruins of the old Dunbar Castle, when the sea and the sky, the waves and the clouds, were mingled together as one. We never thought of playing truant, but after I was 5 or 6 years old, I ran away to the seashore or the fields almost every Saturday, and every day in the school vacations except Sundays, though solemnly warned that I must play at home in the garden and backyard, lest I should learn to think bad thoughts and say bad words, all in vain, in spite of the sure, sore punishments that followed like shadows. The natural, inherited wildness in our blood ran true in its glorious course, as invincible and unstoppable as stars. With my school lessons, Father made me learn hymns and Bible verses. For learning Rock of Ages, he gave me a penny, and I thus became suddenly rich. Scotch boys are seldom spoiled with money. We thought more of a penny those economical days than the poorest American schoolboy thinks of a dollar. To decide what to do with that first penny was an extravagantly serious affair. I ran in great excitement up and down the street examining the tempting goodies in the shop windows before venturing on so important an investment. My playmates also became excited when the wonderful news got abroad that Johnny Muir had a penny, hoping to obtain a taste of the orange, apple, or candy it was likely to bring forth. This next short little story surprised me. Remember, the date is approximately 1840. At this time, infants were baptized and vaccinated a few days after birth. I remember very well a fight with the doctor when my brother David was vaccinated. This happened, I think, before I was sent to school. I couldn't imagine what the doctor, a tall, severe-looking man in black, was doing to my brother. But as mother, who was holding him in her arms, offered no objection, I looked on quietly while he scratched the arm until I saw blood. Then, unable to trust even my mother, I managed to spring up high enough to grab and bite the doctor's arm, yelling that I was na gone to let him hurt my bonny brither, while to my utter astonishment, mother and the doctor only laughed at me. So far from complete, at times, is sympathy between parents and children, and so much like wild beasts are baby boys, little fighting, biting, climbing pagans. It appears natural for children to be fond of water, although the Scotch method of making every duty dismal contrived to make necessary bathing for health terrible to us. I well remember among the awful experiences of childhood being taken by the servant to the seashore when I was between 2 and 3 years old, stripped at the side of a deep pool in the rocks, plunged into it among crawling crawfish and slippery, wriggling, snake-like eels, and drawn up gasping and shrieking, only to be plunged down again and again. As the time approached for this terrible bathing, I used to hide in the darkest corners of the house, and oftentimes a long search was required to find me, but after we were a few years older, we enjoyed bathing with other boys as we wandered along the shore, careful, however, not to get into a pool that had an invisible boy-devouring monster at the bottom of it. Such pools, miniature maelstroms, were called sunken in goats and were well known to most of us. Nevertheless, we never ventured into any pool on strange parts of the coast before we had thrust a stick into it, and if the stick were not pulled out of our hands, we boldly entered and enjoyed splashing and ducking long ere we had learned to swim. One of our best playgrounds was the famous old Dunbar Castle, to which King Edward fled after his defeat at Bannockburn. It was built more than 1,000 years ago, and though we knew little of its history, we had heard many mysterious stories of the battles fought about its walls, and firmly believed that every bone we found in the ruins belonged to an ancient warrior. We tried to see who could climb highest on the crumbling peaks and crags, and took chances that no cautious mountaineer would try. That I did not fall and finish my rock scrambling in those adventurous boyhood days seems now a reasonable wonder. And he describes changing schools. Of course, I had a terrible lot of fighting to do because a new scholar had to meet every one of his age who dared to challenge him, this being the common introduction to a new school. It was very strenuous for the first month or so, establishing my fighting rank, taking up new studies, especially Latin and French, getting acquainted with new classmates, and the master and his rules. In the first few Latin and French lessons, Mr. Lyon blandly smiled at our comical blunders, but pedagogical weather of the severest kind quickly set in, when for every mistake, everything short of perfection, the tawse was promptly applied. We had to get 3 lessons every day in Latin, 3 in French, and as many in English, besides spelling, history, arithmetic, and geography. Word lessons in particular, the wouldst, couldst, shouldst, have loved kind, were kept up with much warlike thrashing until I had committed the whole of the French, Latin, and English grammars to memory, and in connection with reading lessons, we were called on to recite parts of them with the rules over and over again, as if all the regular and irregular incomprehensible verb stuff was poetry. In addition to all this, Father made me learn so many Bible verses every day that by the time I was 11 years of age, I had about 3/4 of the Old Testament and all of the New by heart and by sore flesh. I could recite the New Testament from the beginning of Matthew to the end of Revelation without a single stop. The dangers of cramming and of making scholars study at home instead of letting their little brains rest were never heard of in those days. We carried our school books home in a strap every night and committed to memory our next day's lessons before we went to bed, and to do that we had to bend our attention as closely on our tasks as lawyers on great million-dollar cases. I can't conceive of anything that would now enable me to concentrate my attention more fully than when I was a mere stripling boy, and it was all done by whipping, thrashing in general. Old-fashioned Scotch teachers spent no time in seeking short roads to knowledge or in trying any of the newfangled psychological methods so much in vogue nowadays. There was nothing said about making the seats easy or the lessons easy. We were simply driven point-blank against our books like soldiers against the enemy and sternly ordered, "Up and at 'em, commit your lessons to memory." If we failed in any part, however slight, we were whipped, for the grand, simple, all-sufficing Scotch discovery had been made that there was a close connection between the skin and the memory, and that irritating the skin excited the memory to any required degree. And on to the highest part of our playground, back of the school, commanded a view of the sea, and we loved to watch the passing ships, and judging by their rigging, make guesses as to the ports they had sailed from, those to which they were bound, what they were loaded with, their tonnage, and so on. In stormy weather, they were all smothered in clouds and spray, and showers of salt scud torn from the tops of the waves came flying over the playground wall. In those tremendous storms, many a brave ship foundered or was tossed and smashed on the rocky shore. When a wreck occurred within a mile or two of the town, we often managed, by running fast, to reach it and pick up some of the spoils. In particular, I remember visiting the battered fragments of an unfortunate brig or schooner that had been loaded with apples, and finding fine, unpitiful sport in rushing into the spent waves and picking up the red-cheeked fruit from the frothy, seething foam. All of our school books were extravagantly illustrated with drawings of every kind of sailing vessel, and every boy owned some sort of craft whittled from a block of wood and trimmed with infinite pains, sloops, schooners, brigs, and full-rigged ships with their sails and string ropes properly adjusted and named for us by some old sailor. These precious toy craft with lead keels we learned to sail on a pond near the town. With the sails set at the proper angle to the wind, they made fast, straight voyages across the pond to boys on the other side who readjusted the sails and started them back on the return voyages. Oftentimes, fleets of half a dozen or more were started together in exciting races. And breakfast in those old Lang Syne days were simple oatmeal porridge, usually with a little milk or treacle, served in wooden dishes called luggies, formed of staves, hooped together like miniature tubs about 4 or 5 inches in diameter. One of the staves, the lug or ear, a few inches longer than the other, served as a handle, while the number of luggies ranged in a row on a dresser indicated the size of the family. We never dreamed of anything to come after the porridge or of asking for more. Our portions were consumed in about a couple of minutes and then off to school. At noon, we came racing home ravenously hungry. The midday meal called dinner was usually vegetable broth, a small piece of boiled mutton, and barley meal scone. None of us liked the barley scone bread, therefore, we got all we wanted of it, and in desperation had to eat it, for we were always hungry, about as hungry after as before meals. The evening meal was called tea, and was served on our return from school. It consisted, as far as we children were concerned, of half a slice of white bread, without butter, barley scone, and warm water with a little milk and sugar in it, a beverage called content, which warmed but neither cheered nor inebriated. Immediately after tea, we ran across the street with our books to Grandfather Gilroy, who took pleasure in seeing us and hearing us recite our next day's lessons. Then back home to supper, usually a boiled potato and a piece of barley scone, then family worship and to bed. And now the beginning of chapter 2, A New World. Our grammar school reader, called, I think, McCullough's Course of Reading, contained a few natural history sketches that excited me very much and left a deep impression, especially a fine description of the fishhawk and the bald eagle, by the Scotch ornithologist Wilson, who had the good fortune to wander for years in the American woods while the country was yet mostly wild. I read his description over and over again till I got the vivid picture he drew by heart. The long-winged hawk circling over the heaving waves, every motion watched by the eagle perched on the top of a crag or dead tree, the fishhawk poising for a moment to take aim at a fish, and plunging under the water, the eagle with kindling eye, spreading his wings ready for instant flight in case the attack should prove successful, the hawk emerging with a struggling fish in his talons and proud flight, the eagle launching himself in pursuit, the wonderful wing work in the sky, the fishhawk, though encumbered with his prey, circling higher, higher, striving hard to keep above the robber eagle, the eagle at length soaring above him, compelling him with a cry of despair to drop his hard-won prey. Then the eagle, steadying himself for a moment to take aim, descending swift as a lightning bolt and seizing the falling fish before it reached the sea. Not less exciting and memorable was Audubon's wonderful story of the passenger pigeon. a beautiful bird flying in vast flocks that darkened the sky like clouds, countless millions assembling to rest and sleep and rear their young in certain forests, miles in length and breadth, 50 or 100 nests in a single tree, the overloaded branches bending low and often breaking, the farmers gathering from far and near, beating down countless thousands of the young and old birds from their nests and roosts with long poles at night, and in the morning driving their bands of hogs, some of them brought from farms 100 miles distant to fatten on the dead and wounded covering the ground. In another of our reading lessons, some of the American forests were described. The most interesting of the trees to us boys was the sugar maple, and soon after we had learned this sweet story, we heard everybody talking about the discovery of gold in the same wonder-filled country. One night when David and I were at Grandfather's fireside, solemnly learning our lessons as usual, my father came in with news, the most wonderful, most glorious, that wild boys ever heard. "Bairns," he said, "ye need not learn your lessons the night, for we're gane to America the morn." No more grammar, but boundless woods full of mysterious good things, trees full of sugar growing in ground full of gold, hawks, eagles, pigeons filling the sky, millions of birds' nests, and no gamekeepers to stop us in all the wild, happy land. We were utterly, blindly glorious. After Father left the room, Grandfather gave David and me a gold coin apiece for a keepsake and looked very serious, for he was about to be deserted in his lonely old age. And when we, in fullness of young joy, spoke of what we were going to do, of the wonderful birds and their nests, that we should find the sugar and gold, and so on, and promised to send him a big box full of that tree sugar packed in gold from the glorious paradise over the sea, poor lonely grandfather, about to be forsaken, looked with downcast eyes on the floor, and said in a low, trembling, troubled voice, "Ah, poor laddies, you'll find something else o'er the sea, for by gold and sugar, birds' nests and freedom for lessons and schools. You'll find plenty hard, hard work." And so we did, but nothing he could say could cloud our joy or abate the fire of youthful, hopeful, fearless adventure. Nor could we, in the midst of such measureless excitement, see or feel the shadows and sorrows of his darkening old age. To my schoolmates met that night on the street, I shouted the glorious news, "I'm gone to America in the morn." None would believe it. I said, "We'll just you see if I'm in the school in the morn." Next morning we went by rail to Glasgow and thence joyfully sailed away from beloved Scotland, flying to our fortunes on the wings of the winds, carefree as thistle seeds. We could not then know what we were leaving, what we were to encounter in the new world, nor what our gains were likely to be. We were too young and full of hope, for fear or regret, but not too young to look forward with eager enthusiasm to the wonderful, schoolless, bookless American wilderness. Even the natural heart pain of parting from Grandfather and Grandmother Gilroy, who loved us so well, and from mother and sisters and brother, was quickly quenched in young joy. Father took with him only my sister Sarah, 13 years of age, myself, 11, and brother David, 9, leaving my eldest sister Margaret and the 3 youngest of the family, Daniel, Mary, and Anna, with mother, to join us after a farm had been found in the wilderness and a comfortable house made to receive them. And I'll stop there and continue next week traveling across the sea with John Muir and traveling to Wisconsin. This is Maggie Jones reading from The Story of My Boyhood and Youth by John Muir. Thank you for listening.